So, Cecilia, welcome. And thank you for agreeing to join in this event. I'd just like to say we obviously the kind of the key notion that we're trying to look at tonight and tomorrow is we've called it self-portraiture. We've deliberately gone for self-portraiture rather than say autobiography in film or self-representation. We've tried to focus deliberately on self-portraiture. Having said that, obviously, in practice, these issues tend to be related. So we started with the idea of, when we saw that Cecilia's book had just come out, Performing Authorship, we saw, those of you who may have read the book, there obviously are connections with the notion of self-portraiture. Cecilia uses the word self-portraiture at various times throughout her book, particularly in one of the chapters. So really what I thought would be the best way to start is if we simply started with this notion of performing authorship. In other words, you know, most of us who've had anything to do with studying film have always come across the idea of the author or the auteur or auteur theory or various sort of terms like that. What I wanted to start off with really was just to, you know, a very sort of basic question was, why did you come up with this notion of performance and performativity and performing authorship in terms of your kind of research and the general strategy that you wanted to pursue? And also, I suppose, although it's a sort of, maybe it's the same question, but you know, in what sense do you think by adding the word performing to authorship, you're kind of bringing something new to a debate, which is a debate that's obviously been around pretty much for as long as we've had university type film studies, if you like.
Yeah.
Okay, so that we could start with that and then maybe move on to some other issues related to that. But I thought it would be a good way to start with that point first.
Okay, first I would like to thank you, Michael and Laura Mulvey, and the organizers of the event, Laura Buzetta, Muriel and Marlene, for inviting me. It's really a great privilege and an honor to be invited to be part of this event, exciting program, and also to be given the opportunity to discuss the book. So, the notion of performing authorship, I thought that the author, the figure of the film author, needed to be reassessed, and I thought that the idea of performance was something important and that would help us understand authorship or see it in a different light. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, as I was writing, I kept, it became a phrase. And so I think I can maybe start by explaining, you know, the implications of this and what I mean by that. To begin with, performing authorship, the performing act both as a verb and an adjective, mm-hmm. I think, throughout the book. It would be like an attributive verb, I think, is what you call. Verb in the sense that I'm trying to call attention to the act of performing the function of authoring a work. So the book deals with directors that appear on the screen in their own films, either imprint the films with the image of their bodies or sometimes just through voiceover, but there is an element, I mean, in all of the films I study, there is self-inscription. A self-inscription that would draw attention to the authorial function of this person that we hear or that we see on the screen. So performing authorship in that sense is the act of performing authorship, literally. But I also thought that the notion of performance, especially if you think about how it is used in performance theory, mm-hmm. Really illuminates some elements of authorship that I thought needed to be reassessed. So I wanted to use the word performing, evoking performance, to talk about both the act of masking the mm-hmm. author or masquerade, and also dealing with some key notions that are explored in performance theory, which is the notions of repetition, emphasis on process, and there's something on the, I don't know if it's a problem, and the notion of presence. Mm-hmm. So what I was thinking is that, okay, authorship or the figure of the author has been in crisis since the 60s, mm-hmm. But it resists. I mean, people keep talking about authors and so on. And the crisis of authorship is often articulated in terms of the disappearance of the author, the death of the author, or the author as absent, especially in structuralism and then in a different way in post-structuralist approaches to the author. So my idea was to say, okay, And why is that? Because there are issues that are considered requirements for the things that a person needs to have in order to be considered an author has been challenged. So these are requirements for originality, uniqueness, self-expression, so the ability to express a subject's inner life, authority and control over the work. And we all know that these things are difficult to achieve, but still the author is there. So I thought maybe we can focus, acknowledge that that is part of authorship and not something that would challenge this status of an author. And rather than speak of disappearance or death, we could talk about presence. Mm-hmm. And not only ability to express oneself, but be present or be depicted in the act of trying to express oneself.
So just to clarify then, I mean, one thing, before I read the book, one thing that I'd been thinking about was the idea of almost performing the function of authorship in a more kind of social and cultural sphere. So yeah. I was wondering whether you were going to be looking at the way that certain filmmakers act out being, you know, Tarantino, or act out being Jean-Luc Godard in the non-filmic sphere, as it were, you know, in the public the public space. Mm-hmm. But in this, you deliberately don't go towards that. You're much more in concern with the notion of the presence and the body of the filmmaker, the artist, within the work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think there are a lot of studies that talk about the performance of the author exactly, precisely, in the extra filmic, outside of the text. There's a certain historical turn in auteur studies, or trying to also take into account elements of production, production context, etc., that impact or challenge the status of the author or the author as a persona outside of the film. So the author's, the construction of the director as an author by critics, but also by studio executive for marketing purposes, and by their own directors as well. But I wanted to focus on how they do that in the films, which would have a closer connection with creative processes, and so also to explain how we might detect or identify the presence of an author in the film, which is something that I believe many people long for, like this desire to kind of associate a film with a maker, with an individual, or multiple individuals.
I was just thinking it might be useful at this stage, maybe. I mean, could you give some of the kind of key forms or the key ways in which the author therefore is present? I mean, you talk about being in the shot, for example. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, a kind of an obvious point would be to talk about the voice. That the voice would be one way in which, you know, a filmmaker could be present within the work without physically necessarily appearing. And then presumably, once we're talking about physical presence within the frame, or within the frame and around the frame, I suppose, there would be different ways in which that could happen, presumably. So could you maybe sort of talk us through some of the sort of three or four main ways in which the author is performing or present in the way.
Yes, so maybe I can then talk about the kind of different genres or modes that I.
Yeah, that would be
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I talk about voice over narration, in which the author, for example, I talk about two or three things, and then Sarah Turner's Perestroika, in which you hear the voice of the author, and the author is actually talking about the process. So. But and these two films are in the context of the essay film. So one of the modes that I explore is the essay film, in which you actually, I mean, that's the most clearly identifiable aspect of performing authorship, because I'm talking about directors that appear in the film in an authorial function, and that in a way discuss the process. So I talk about self-portrait, that we can move into discuss more detail later, an essayistic documentary like F for Fake, where you have Orson Welles talking about forgery in the arts market, but also about himself in a way, and portrays himself as some sort of a magician. So in the essay film, I mean, essay films tend to be very much about authoring and about the author, him or herself. Gauguin, there's a commentary to the DVD of Saint Soleil, and Gauguin, I like very much what Jean-Pierre Gauguin talks about when he discusses the Chris Marker film. He says, and that really sums up the notion of performing authorship, he says, you don't learn anything about the author, but you learn something about authorship mm-hmm. in Saint Soleil. So that's one example. Another way in which you can identify this notion or this instance of performing authorship is in documentaries, especially ones in which you have the director not so much expressing their own point of view or analyzing what we see, but they see themselves as catalysts for what happens in front of the camera. I discussed that in relation to the works of Jean Rouch mm-hmm. and the Brazilian documentarian Eduardo Coutinho specifically. And one of the notion of performing authorship is relevant there because it's not so much about self-expression, but it's about presence. So that's, I think, a clear example of that. And then I talk about fiction films in which the author appears in the guise of a full figure. And then I draw that notion of the full from Bakhtin's discussion of the full in literature, and the fool being this character that refuses to belong to the world, and the fool has an element of I mean, he's an outsider, he sees the world as an alien, so it's somebody who doesn't belong to that world, so he has some exteriority to that, and I wanted to, so I thought this was an interesting way to approach the works of some directors who appear in the films as full figures, as clownish figures, because again, it would kind of put emphasis on the director's presence, in addition to, specifically in the cases that I discuss, which are the films by Godard, some films by Godard and Woody Allen, because, you know, their style is so recognizable. In that case, it's not just about presence, but it's about style as well. But their presence stands out in a way that you don't see in a film directed by Clint Eastwood and featuring Clint Eastwood, or you don't see in John Cassavetes and you don't see in Polanski, because these are authors who might be appearing as actors in their films, but they disappear behind the characters they play. Right. So you might say, oh yeah, I know, this is Clint Eastwood and he's also the director, but you know, he's not trying to evoke that function, because in the sense that he becomes part of the diegesis in the films he plays right. in, okay. whereas Godard, I can show examples of that, and mm-hmm. Woody Allen, they kind of always remain in the margins. They always establish a connection with their biography, in the case of the Godard films that I analyze, or with the real world, in the case of Woody Allen, because he brings to the film the figure of the stand-up comedian. Mm. And the stand-up mode, the stand-up is a kind of comedy in which, no matter how fictional the events being discussed are, they are supposed to be part of the author's biography, or they have a connection with a current reality, a current situation. They're very topical in that sense, and they're also very attuned to what happens in the audience. So part of the work of the stand-up comedian is to react to what happens in the audience. Okay. Do they laugh? And I thought that this sense of connection with an immediate reality, in the case of Woody Allen, because he brings this kind of element of self, stand-up, calls attention to his presence, a presence that somehow makes him stand out, be somehow in between the fictional world and the real world. I use this image of, when I talk about the author's existence within the film, or I talk about, if you think about a chemistry, it's like there is a chemical precipitation mm-hmm. of the author. Like, he doesn't really disappear in the film. He doesn't really seamlessly integrate in the fiction, in the narrative. So that's one aspect of, I mean, the way in which you can perceive the presence of an author. I don't know if you want.
Can I suggest, therefore, what we could maybe do is think about some of the examples that you use. So, for example, yeah, I was thinking what we could maybe do is talk about, in one chapter in particular, where you talk about the film essay, really, and you talk about the film essay, and you explicitly use the word self-portrait a number of times within that chapter on the film essay.
Yeah.
And I was thinking it might be interesting to actually look at some examples. So there are two key examples, it seems to me, that you use. You talk about Godard and you talk about the self, which is called, subtitled, December self-portrait. I mean, it explicitly puts the word self-portrait in the title.
Yeah.
And then you also talk about the Plage d'Agnès, which is the Varda piece. So, and I was thinking it might be quite interesting if you maybe sort of talked a bit more explicitly about those two cases, because I think they have you know, interesting things in common in terms of the generation of filmmaker they represent as well, because that might also be an issue in this business of self-portraiture, it strikes me.
Yeah.
And also, I think in both cases, there is that kind of mixture of self-portraiture in the sense of very much about showing the process of filmmaking. So self-portraiture becomes a question, it's a reflection as much on the filmmaking process as it is on necessarily the personality of the filmmaker. And yet there are also very strong autobiographical, personal, intimate elements in both. So I was thinking it might be an interesting way of kind of setting up that opposition for tonight, but also to some extent for tomorrow as well, because it strikes me that whichever way you kind of work it, when you talk about self-portraiture, you always come back to autobiography, and when you talk about autobiography, you always come back to self-portraiture. So there's a desire to separate them and make them very, very distinct modes within this field of self-representation. And yet it seems to me they always tend to come back and kind of complement each other in some ways. So would that be okay? Could you maybe talk us through the Varda and the Gier, or one or both?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, if we have time, it might also be nice to then illustrate this idea of the performing author, when the author is literally taking on a fictional role or a dramatic role, and yet we still feel that there is a sense in which they are playing themselves, you know. So in the Prénom Carmen and those kind of roles that Godard has played, the idiot fool role, and then the Woody Allen. So should we maybe take it that way now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just so a couple of words before I brought some clips that I think can illustrate some of the aspects of performing authorship that I thought it would be worth discussing. Two things about these two films, like in terms of them being self-portraits and the connection with performing authorship, is that the self-portrait, as we were talking about, is always like representing the artist as artist in a way. And you know that the artist is looking at him or herself and painting that. So he's the object and the producer of the painting, if you think in terms of art. Self-portrait is not exclusively a painterly mode. Also, there's actual literary self-portraits and filmic ones. And, of course, the importance of performing authorship, I mean, the instances that I'm exploring are authors that appear as authors. So there's a connection there already. So one of the things that is explored, and I think Laura Rascaroli explores in her discussion of the self-portrait, is this kind of ambivalent movement towards revelation and concealment. So, like, you know, desire to expose oneself, but also disguise oneself, or kind of, she talks about some sense of mise en abîme. I mean, you see the artist through the eyes of the artist, so there's a great sense of mediation. So the artist is looking, if an artist is painting themselves, they're painting themselves as they see each other, and you see them through their own seeing of themselves. So there's a sense of degrees of separation between viewer and artist, which is another important thing, I think, in this notion of performing authorship, which is, again, involves masking and masquerade as much as it might involve a desire to reveal oneself or one's essence, which is problematic notion. So I think maybe I could, so in both films by the Beaches of Agnes and GLG JLG, you see almost a resistance to talk about personal life to begin with. So in the two films you see them very much as artists. Mm-hmm. And I think Beaches of Agnes has been defined as a self-portrait, but it has a narrative that you don't find in JLG, JLG. But I think one of the things that makes the film, puts the film into that category is that she very much appears as, portrays herself as an artist, as a filmmaker. Whatever element of her biography is there, it's discussed through her work. So mm-hmm. she talks about the death of Demi, but that's to talk about the films she made about Demi afterwards. So she's always portrayed as an artist. And there are two scenes in Beaches of Agnes that I would like to show in which you see Cameron Lens movements kind of expressing or dramatizing this kind of opposite movements towards moving away from the author and coming, trying to get closer to the author. So let me show. It's just because I think the images are very suggestive. Okay. So these are two. The mouse is not. Oh, woke up. So let me find it. She's not responding. Let's see if it works with the mouse. Okay. So, this is the first clip. So what you see here is like Varda talking about Cleo, her French New Wave film, and then...
Should I have the lights on?
Okay.
Are you ready to go? Lights off?
Yes.
Okay.
What I like about the superimposition of these images is it generates a dizzying sensation. Can I talk in the dark? Is it okay? Because then I would just like move to the next one without having...
There.
Yeah, yeah. So you have Varda walking backwards, which is a movement that she uses a lot. And that's part of... she kind of externalizes this kind of journey down memory lane. Like every time she memorizes something, or a few times in the film, she walks backwards. So it's like she's walking back to her past. And you have a forward-tracking camera following her. And then she superimposes that, or I don't remember if it's a dissolve. I think it's a superimposition. That, with the image of Cleo, the character, moving towards the camera moving backwards. So you have this kind of opposite camera movements, forwards and backwards, tracking forwards and backwards, and opposite character figure movements, like Varda walking backwards and Cleo moving forwards. Which, again, I think, you know, it becomes like a way to visually dramatize this kind of authorial impulse to at once reveal oneself, but also dismask oneself. And I like the last, you know, the image of the episode. Just before that, we'll see Varda's face framed by, you know, the Cleo, yeah. The film. So it's like, you know, the author's portrait is framed by her work. So it's always, she's only relevant to us as a filmmaker, not... you know, as a historical, not in terms of her personal biography. And I find the second clip is just doing the same thing, but using the frame, embedded frames within frames, to kind of create that kind of degrees of separation, increase the degrees of separation between the author and the audience. So this is the last sequence in the film where she's receiving, I mean, friends come to her house to celebrate her birthday. The camera moving away from her through jump cuts and also through forward tracking. So the dizzy effect is created not from opposite movements, but the same, but the same movement. Do you want me to?
Well, I just wondered if there was anybody wanted to
ask a question about this.
A moderate bit of
light,
so it's not completely dark. I just wondered at that point whether anybody wanted to come back on in terms of the particular thing that we saw there with Plage d'Agnès, because the thing that occurs to me is that I can't remember the exact chronology of it, but there's also the Les Glaneurs, isn't there?
Which is
an earlier piece, which is in many ways is a self-portrait, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it goes, it's sometimes since I saw the film, but I mean, it's a film that people have written about quite a lot. But it seems to me that in Les Glaneurs, you get a situation where it's almost a documentary about a social topic that almost ends up being a self-portrait indirectly. That's always been one of the things I felt about it, that it didn't sort of start off as being, I'd like to do my filmic self-portrait. It's about a kind of almost ecological type of subject matter in terms of, you know, society and how things, recuperation of materials and so forth. And it kind of almost indirectly becomes a self-portrait of the artist at work, because you get all of that stuff with the mini DV and her hands, and it begins to, in a sense, it's almost like you get the reflection, the seed of the idea for something which is a reflection about kind of her career and her life looking back, almost comes from that, it seems to me, in that moment in Les Glaneurs where you have, yeah, you know, I don't know if those of you who've seen it, but it's a little bit about her hands and almost the beginnings of realization that she is of a certain age, and maybe that sort of that. So it's that kind of typical autobiographical topos, which is, you know, if you look at all the great literary autobiographies, there's always that sort of, you know, the person reaches a certain moment in life and they want to look back and take stock of what they've done and so forth. So I just wondered the if you thought, you know, the connection between the two from Les Glaneurs to this one, which seems, as you say, very clearly about kind of framing or I love those dissolves between the present and the past, and her past being essentially her work.
Yeah. Les Glaneurs is a film that calls attention to the affinities between the self-portrait and the essay film, which is very much about, I mean, the part of the essay, the idea of the essay film is to talk about several subjects and about the author, him or herself. So it's, I think that's, you know, that raises that question. I mean, how do these two modes differentiate themselves? And where I think it's been a while since I've seen Les Glaneurs, but the Beaches of Agnès seems more focused in that sense, which is about her career.
That's right.
And it's about filmmaking, it's about photography, but you know, everything that is associated with her professional life.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a kind of intermediate thing, was that exhibition, wasn't there, in Paris?
The just between Les Glaneurs and
the Fondation Cartier, wasn't it? Which was very much about the sea and beach, but it had a lot of that thematics of the sea and beaches built into it as well, didn't it? Mm-hmm. If I remember rightly, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a very romantic element to Beaches of Agnès as well, because she says, if people could open me up, they would find. No, if you open people up, you can see landscapes. If you open me up, you see beaches. Mm-hmm. And this idea of, you know, the interior, the subjectivity, or the artist's soul being reflected in the landscape, which is a very romantic idea, is evoked in there. And that's important for the notion of performing authorship, because I talk about the author's exteriority being something important. So if you think in terms, since I talk about performance, if you make an analogy with acting, with actors, you have that kind of acting methodology or method, which comes from Stanislavski and then is translated as method acting in Hollywood, which begins with feelings, begins with emotions, and then those translate into action, right? So, you know, the actor is required to, you know, go back to their past memories and remember emotions that are similar to the ones the characters are experiencing, and from this kind of inner emotion comes the performance. But there's another approach to acting, which would be the equivalent of my approach to performing authorship, in which the emotion comes from gestures, from the movement, from action. So you kind of repeat movements, physical, bodily movements, or actions, or say things repetitively. And from that, you might or may not generate emotion, but at least you express something. But that's something that begins outside and it might or might not reach the inside, whereas it's not necessarily coming from the inside and then to the outside. But it's important, I mean, it's important to talk, it's not about doing away with the idea of expressing subjectivity, self-expression, or even this romantic notion that the world mirrors the art. But it's dealing with that notion, not necessarily believing it on embracing it, but this notion has to be part of, you know, the conception of the artist as artist or the act of authoring a work.
I mean, with Varda, her sort of workshop in Paris is kind of features in the film. And I was thinking almost you could imagine a kind of an iconography of self-portraiture, which would involve maybe some kind of often a natural space like a landscape. With Godard, it's often in Gier, but in all of Godard's sort of 90s onwards work, it's obviously around Lake Geneva and where he lives, and those landscapes are one of the sort of key kind of iconographic figures that return, and also obviously the workshop, the space of work, the editing suite, the office, and that comes across very strongly in Gier, obviously, although it's present in lots of other Godardian works. I was just wondering, unless somebody was really absolutely wanted to ask a question about this, whether it might be helpful if you'd now just made that link to why you felt that using Gier in particular was such a strong... Yeah. I mean, it seems to me very clear that, you know, the choice, in terms of your corpus, the choice of this, you know, is absolutely, you know, self-evident and very, very rich. I just wondered why, or equally, why you thought that Gier was a you know, almost necessary object to talk about in this context, in your essay film / self-portraiture chapter.
Two things attract me, I mean, several things, but two things that come to mind now. One is Silverman's essay on the film, which talks about the author's receiver.
Right.
Which I think was interesting, especially when it's a film that defines itself as self-portrait. To begin with, there is this, again, desire to kind of mask or this kind of elusiveness that you find somehow in Varda's film as well, with this kind of two opposite movements. And then a sense of imminent death, which is something that Laura discusses in her discussion of the self-portrait, that is present in Varda's as well because of her age and because of the death of Demi. Death is a very important element of the film. And it's equally relevant in JLG, where he talks about dead people, a dead cinema, and a sense of his own imminent death is almost like he's writing a weird, non-narrative, self-obituary. So those are the reasons why I thought it was an important film. And also because it beautifully illustrated the notion of performing authorship in this kind of notion that, in this portrayal of the author in the act, and I'll show still images, not only in the act of creating, but in the act of receiving. That brings me back also to Silverman's title, The Author's Receiver. So these are some of the images you get from the film, and if you haven't seen it, it's like other self-portrait films, and I think the Kramer film that we're going to see now, it takes a while. They're called self-portraits, but it takes a while before you see the body of the author in the image. And it's the same in JLG. It takes about, I think I timed it once, 6 minutes before you see Godard's, you have a good grasp of Godard's image. So you begin, the film shows you this image, which I think is the first, which is true enough, it's a picture of Godard as a kid, but not everyone would know that. But then you see images of his glasses, of corners of his house, or you see images of him very much from afar. So I'm not going to show images only from this beginning. I'm going to show the kind of images that represent the ways in which he wants to represent himself. So to begin with, you see him again, far away from us and framed by this window or door, sliding door, I think it is. But again, frame within frames, increasing this degrees of separation between us and the artist. Images of him from afar.
But there's the landscape, though, again.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing, though, Cecilia, I just wanted to just if I could just interrupt slightly. I mean, the other thing, though, it seems to me, you may take a long time to actually see physically
Giordano's
body, but the voice is there right from the start, isn't it?
And it's but he makes this kind of moribund voice, like from
the
grave.
Yeah, several voices, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he introduces the film by giving instructions to an actor, reproducing an actor's, what would be an actor's thought before they go on stage, and then instructions for a director or what the director would be thinking. So he talks about, you know, incarnating a character, going on stage, and then he says, thinking about exits and entrances, coordinating entrances and exits. So he speaks in voiceover, his voiceover discourse evokes both the work of an actor and the work of a director. Which establishes the director as an actor in that case as well,
mm-hmm.
or conflates these two images. But here, again, you see him seeing, reading, drawing, reading again, writing, looking at images, writing again, and that's it. So always, again, the artist at work. And also that kind of lack of linearity, which is, of course, very important to the notion of self-portrait, and that would differentiate that from autobiography.
Right.
So okay. It's more,
Right. Now, what I was going to say was I'm getting signals from the front row that we need to bring things to this first part of the discussion to a close. I was just going to say, in relation to Godard and self-portraiture, I mean, obviously, it's an interesting example because there are so many going back even. I was thinking even going back to Camera Oeil, you know, the Godard's part of in Winding Vietnam, Far From Vietnam, which is, again, if you wanted to have a kind of a classic expression of what it might mean for a filmmaker to film himself or herself at work and reflecting about the process of what they're doing, that would be a kind of a almost classical sort of example of that. But there are so many kind of accumulated over the years of, and it tends to be more the self-portrait side of it than the kind of autobiographical side of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And in some ways, I think what's quite interesting about Giorget is the fact that there's the denial by putting autoportrait in the title very clearly, and even, I think he says several times in the film, self-portraiture, not autobiography, as if somehow did not want to do an autobiography. And yet, in a sense, it begins with one of the most sort of explicitly, I mean, what more could you do that's more intimate than to show a picture of yourself as a child, a particular picture that had never appeared, as far as I'm aware, in any work previously. So there is quite a strong sort of paradoxical element there that it's like most things with Godard, that Godard does, you've always got to let him say what he wants to say, but assume he's doing the opposite kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or there's two, you know what I mean? There's what he says he's doing and what the work is doing. And mm-hmm. I think that's, for me, it's a very clear.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, all of the kind of commentators on that piece, the thing that they almost fetishized was, you know, was it really a photograph of him when he was a child? And when Alain Berguela produced the evidence that it really was a photograph of him as a child, it was almost, right, okay. So, I mean, there is, but I think in terms of that movement between the two, the sense of showing the process, the artist at work, and exposing, because, I mean, there are also some Godardian works where the exposure is very, very kind of brutal as well. You know, the self-exposure is very, very brutal, like in Numéro 2, or some of the very short pieces from the 80s. So I think that that would be a kind of a very rich terrain. So before we move on to the second part, does anybody have a kind of a pressing, urgent question that they'd like to put to Cecilia? Oh yeah, please do, because it is a conversation.
This film here, it's just about this film here. What was it called again?
It's called JLG, JLG.
The initials of his name.
Which is basically his initials, Jean-Luc Godard. So it's JLG, JLG, Self-Portrait of December, or December Self-Portrait.
Self-Portrait in December, I think.
Yeah. But it's Autoportrait de Décembre, isn't it? So. Sorry?
Slightly longer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You said at the beginning that the two aspects of performance that interested you in performing authorship were presence and repetition.
Yeah.
Could you say something about repetition, please? As you talked a lot about presence.
Yeah, yeah. It goes against one of these requirements for originality, and repetition comes from repeating oneself, so recycling one's own works, and also recycling other works, but it goes against this notion of something that needs to be necessarily fresh and original and unique. Of course, the notion of the film auteur in cinema, the auteur, comes from repetition comes from the requirement for repetition of in the sense that, you know, you have to have a consistent style, you have to have recurring elements in style or themes or obsessions. But I like this notion of repetition in terms of recycling, but also in terms of non-unique in the sense that you repeat what others do. That actually would require a very long answer, because it has to do with the notion of with how performance theory comes into the picture. Repetition is an important idea for performance theory, because which doesn't talk about acting, only talks about performance, many elements of performatic elements in social life. And that goes questions notions of what it means to express oneself, questions notions of what a subject is, with kind of questions notions of what Judith Butler talks about, the metaphysics of substance, this idea that, you know, there is an essence, everybody has, an individual has an essence that is there, that pre-exists. They might be informed by their experience, but that is unique in a way. Post-structuralists would say that's a construct. This notion of an essence is a construct. So performance theory comes and say, okay, it calls attention to actions or discourses that do not have a subject, which again brings us back also to even to structuralism, where it's about, you know, there's a language that is there, that does not necessarily that precedes the subject. So, for example, in performance theory, they talk about rituals or repetitive discourses. So, for example, when every time somebody gets married, now I declare you wife and husband. So that says, you know, there's not subject there. It doesn't matter who says that. So there's this kind of disconnection between language and subject or an individual. So the repetition comes from that aspect of performance, that aspect of life, and saying maybe authoring is also like repeating formulas, repeating words. You know, that goes back to Barthes. I mean, all this notion of performing authorship is really going back to to structuralist and post-structuralist writers, and say what they say. I agree with everything they say, and I think that it's still true, but instead of talking about that as death or disappearance or absence, I prefer to focus on the exteriority, on presence. That's why, and bring a more optimistic, maybe positive approach to the figure of authors in general, but film authors in that case. Did I answer it?
Oh, lovely. Okay. Right. So, if you don't mind, I think we might just introduce a slight sort of artificial pause there whilst I seamlessly switch from one